Good morning. So last time we talked about removing links in distance vector routing because our routing needs to deal with nodes and links going away, not just entering the network, especially because a big point of having a routing protocol rather than just setting up our routes sort of statically is that we want to handle errors on the network. We handle things happening and have the network still work. And all our routing protocols achieve that, but we need to do some extra work beyond the sort of simple distance vector idea to handle those cases where a link goes down. We need to update our distance vectors carefully. And we discovered that when we did that, we sometimes had this issue where when a node was unreachable, we'd still have these sort of old routes for it being propagated around the network. And because of how distance vector work, we just keep propagating them, increasing their cost. Because we didn't have the full picture on any node that there really was no link to this node. And this was known as the count to infinity problem. And we learned that the unsatisfying solution the RIP protocol chose for this is that the max distance is 15. If it gets above 15, it's infinity. And their argument is just that if you want to have a bigger network than that, don't use this protocol. So what protocols do you use for that? Well, we learned about these link state protocols, where everyone gets basically a full map of the network. We have to sort of send that to everyone, and our strategy was this thing we called reliable flooding, where we very carefully do the same kind of idea we saw in distance vector of everyone tells their neighbors about everything. But we have to do it in a way where we realize, okay, you know, sometimes we're going to have things get lost, and we need to carefully check to make sure that it actually gets there. And this is more important with link state than distance vector, because with distance vector, if I send a distance vector and it doesn't get there, it's fine. I'm going to send it again in 30 seconds. They'll get it. If link state, if I send a link update and they don't get it, you know, either I need to send like the whole thing, which is going to be very big all the time, and have them refresh that way, or you know, we're going to be out of sync for an indefinite amount of time if I have some design, you know, which is probably preferable, where I like don't send, you know, my list of like all 1,000 routers on our big network every time. And speaking of big networks, we learned that the sort of link state protocols, you know, issue is that because everyone gets the full map of the network, they can become a bit unwieldy. So our solution to that is that, well, we are going to let the system administrator divide up the network into areas, with the name OSPF used, and we'll kind of isolate the areas where they'll only get a summary of the information outside the areas, and that's going to sort of mitigate our amount of extra information we're passing. And when we do this in OSPF, this app does restrict us. It restricts sort of what routes we can take. We're not using sort of complete information. But the idea is the system administrator can choose what the areas are, so this probably doesn't really affect how the network operates. And we learned that they had this trick of having these virtual links where they could make one area sort of span, go across another area when necessary, to have the network not be too disconnected. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so I think I probably should talk about the quiz. And it's possible I miskeyed some things, but... So on the quiz, we have this network map. And the first question is, where could we have the count to infinity problem? And there seems to be a lot of confusion on this. So remember, the count to infinity problem, the idea was that our old route could propagate indefinitely. So in all the cases, when we have a link go down, we can have some sort of old paths to that link propagating for a while. That's kind of the normal operation of distance vector. If we want to avoid that, we can't use distance vector. But what the issue with count to infinity is that we can have them not eventually go away. So usually what will happen is they'll eventually go away because we'll realize, oh, that's actually how I get there. So So for example, if we get rid of AB and BC here, well, B knows that it can't get to anything because it was going through A and C and it realizes that doesn't work anymore. A realizes it can't go directly to B and C realizes it can't go directly to B. And there's going to be some period of time when maybe F, G, and H like have some routes that falsely go through A to get to B when that doesn't work. But eventually what's going to happen... Did I keep this wrong? I keyed this wrong, and I assume most people got it right, and that was not true. So, A should be selected. I will correct that later. So why should A be selected? Because if we have this route to B, right? B is unreachable. And what can happen is G is currently going through F. And G is going to say, F is going to get an update from A saying it can't go there, and G gets an update from F saying it can't go through F. And G can say get an update from H saying, oh, you can go through me, because H has this old route. And then F will go through G, and H will go through F eventually, or H will go through G eventually. Or will it? No, wait, you said G... So G goes through H, H thinks it goes through F, F realizes it can't go through there, but F will go through G, yeah. Have a route through G, yeah. This scenario, A, B, C, D, okay. Oh, that's why, okay. I misread the scenario. I thought it was miskeyed because I read this as A, B, and B, C. So in A, B, and C, D, everything is still reachable. Sorry, that's why I was confused. I misread the option. This is why I should make these explanations in advance. So if A, B, and C, D go down, everything's still reachable, we'll eventually find that. Sorry, thank you for pointing that out, and yes, I can make mistakes here. In the case of AF and FG, AF and FG, everyone, there are nodes that are unreachable. I think AF and FG is probably, because AF and FG cuts off, H is cut off from everywhere. So A knows it can't reach H, but we can have kind of, D here can think it can go through B can think it can go through C, if D, so we can basically have E think it can go through D, think it can go through C, think it can go through B, which causes A to think it can go through B. That's an alternate path to H. So B, I think, should be selected, and I'm sorry for getting that. I'll fix that later. You understand my reasoning here? Question? Yeah.
Why originally would E be going through D instead of A if A is shorter?
E would originally be going through A, assuming the links are all the same cost, which we don't actually, we do say. But basically, E would originally be going through A, and then D, has a tie here, right? Or would it? No, D would originally be going this way, right? So D could choose to go to C instead. If A propagates to E, that gets down, and D propagates there, and that could cause a loop in this direction. And I will correct that key because I should have. So that is AF. Originally miskeyed loop from very old routes. Okay, so in going to this question, we don't need to go over, I think. So here, our question is, we have our link from D to E goes down, and how long is it before A to correct its paths? And A just needs to learn from E. That's the minimum number of messages we need. Once A learns from E that D and E aren't connected anymore, it has a full map of the network that is now accurate, and it can make its next hop decisions correctly. Now, other things in the network might not be making the correct next hop decisions yet, but A will make the correct next hop decision. And then we have this last question here. So asking, if these routers are in different areas, like so, who has less information about other networks? So in the case of router A is an area of 1 and 2 because it's the border router. So it has to have full information about area 0 and area 2. So therefore, it knows everything about the links adjacent to F in this area configuration. If it doesn't have a summary of that, it has the full thing. And router B here is in area 0 and is not a border router. So but area router C is in, and I guess what's confusing is router C is in area 0, but router C is a border router. So router C has some links to area 1 that are going to be summarized for router B. So that's why it doesn't have the full information. It's going to have a summary of what's outside in area 2 going through router C. And I say, and then we have this question on no routing tables would change. So our border routers are C, D, and A. So we have the routes down here and the routes over here. And our summary, and I would argue no routes are going to change because our summary from C and D is just going to be this other area is reachable. You know, it's going to be basically a distance vector for I, J, and K, and the same thing for B, A, B, and E, and area 2. And that's going to give us the same distances. You know, we haven't added any restrictions to what routes we can take. We're going to get the same routes. We're basically doing distance vector, but distance vector gives us the same results with the restrictions of the area crossing. Because our area 0 is, in fact, what we have to go through in the normal routes anyways, right? That's the main thing areas constrain us on, is we have to go through area 0 between areas. We're already doing that the way we've divided this up into areas because we made this whole ring in area 0, I should say. That makes sense? Questions? Okay, so here. I'm sorry for that being haphazard. But yes, I looked at the quiz just a few minutes ago. I'm like, oh gosh, need to cover that. Okay. So, and what we moved on to after talking about link state routing is talking about interdomain routing. And we talked about these kind of different types of relationships we can have between sort of big networks. We have this provider-customer relationship where typically the customer is paying the provider, and basically the idea is because that they're providing what's commonly called, and I probably should write this term down because it comes up a bunch in the real world, they're providing what's called transit. That they're going to carry your packets to and from you to all the other networks. This is in contrast to this peering relationship where they're just going to carry things to themselves and their customers. They're not going to send it on to other networks that haven't already paid them. or otherwise have that type of relationship where they're providing a service for them. And as I mentioned, peering is often settlement-free, meaning that it's considered just mutually beneficial that we both, you know, are obliged to get these packets to the right people for each other, for our customers. We don't want to pay someone else to do that. Let's connect directly so we can make that happen. And I talked about connecting directly, and I realized from some questions that it's probably worth mentioning, how does that work? If I have two big networks, if I'm running a big telephone company and you're running a big telephone company, how do we connect our networks? And there's some different options for like what are we doing to actually build these, connect these big networks to each other? And these options are also the same as sort of if I'm, have a big company and I want have like an office in, in Charlottesville and in Richmond, if I want to connect them, I have the same kind of options. So one option is I can like run a fiber between two buildings. And that's not cheap, but if you want a fast connection, that's a thing that you might need to do. So you'll pay, I gather it's like thousands to tens of thousands per mile to get that done. But if you run a fiber, a bundle of fibers can easily get you hundreds of gigabits if you want that. You can pay for access to a fiber someone else runs. So there's a lot of so-called dark fiber. So why does this happen? So one reason is that if you're running a fiber from Charlottesville to Richmond, most of the cost of running the fiber is the cost of doing the construction work of like digging trenches and or putting things on telephone poles and getting all the permits done. So when you do it, probably you're not running one fiber, probably you're running a bundle of fibers, of like tens of fibers, maybe even over 100 fibers. And you'll have extras, and something you can do commercially is that you can often sort of pay for access to one of these unused but laid fibers. In which case you'll, bring your own networking equipment and you'll just actually physically attach it to that unused fiber. Another thing you can do is you can pay a telecom, like AT&T and other big telecom companies, telecommunications companies, for a site-to-site connection. This is often a service they'll offer a lot of in like big cities, where rather than buying internet service from them, you can buy the service of I'd like 10 gigabits to my other office. And that should be priced cheaper than 10 gigabit internet service because, they're doing less. And also often you can get this with some sort of guarantee about the bandwidth actually being there, which typically you won't get in the same sort of way with internet service. And by guarantee, I have it in quotes because typically the form that takes is they'll say that, if the network connection is down for more than an hour, you get a 25% discount on your month's bill. If it's down for more than a day, you get a 100% discount, something like that. On your probably very substantial month's bill. And another common strategy that's especially for connecting peers is that you might get space in a common data center and pay the data center operator for connection. So for example, UVA's ISP has peering relationships, most of which seem to happen in data centers run by a company called Equinix in Ashburn. So they've paid for a connection to that data center in Ashburn. They have routers, so our ISP physically has routers in that data center in Ashburn. Our primary ISP, and other people who run things on the internet have routers physically there, and we can just connect them by paying the data center operator to run a wire. Okay, so questions about these sort kind of options for like long network connections, sort of in the practical world. Okay, so we talked about these different types of relationships. So this is kind of one thing that we are deciding on when we connect networks, is like, if we're connecting my network to yours, what sort of traffic am I carrying, right? We have these kind of different classes. And there's another decision we have to make, which is, well, we're going to probably connect, if we're a very big network, in multiple places. So two big ISPs, it makes sense probably to, you know, if they have operations in the US and Japan, to connect in the US and Japan. And let's say we're, you know, taking traffic from northern, you know, we have some connection from northern Virginia to Tokyo. And this connection comes from a customer of ISP B and is going to a customer of ISP A. There's kind of two choices here as for where do we send that connection. Do we have ISP B send the packets across the Pacific, or do we have ISP A do it? And both are choices you can justify. Yeah, so if you're ISP B, that Trans-Pacific link is probably one of your most expensive pieces of it. ISP B or ISP A, if you have a Trans-Pacific link, that's probably one of your most expensive pieces of infrastructure. Really expensive to lay and maintain undersea cable. You don't do it very often. So if you're ISP B, from a cost perspective, it's cheaper if you could just give it to ISP A in Northern Virginia, let them take care of getting it to Tokyo. If you're ISP A, you'd really like ISP B not to do that for your costs. On the other hand, if you care about performance, you know, and let's say ISP A, you know, its customer is paying for really good performance for its network, you know, paying extra to get lots of bandwidth, then maybe ISP A might not want the situation where ISP B sends it across, because ISPA wants to make sure that there's enough, that this gets, you know, the full bandwidth that their customer is paying for, so their customer doesn't complain. Or a common place where this might really come up is if ISPA is like Google, right? Or YouTube, right? Or your YouTube, you know, you don't want to have to explain why does the video streaming not work. You want it that, so you might want it to be on your network so you at least control why it doesn't work. So this is like an actual decision that we're going to want to enable when we decide how to connect two ISPs to each other. It's like, we want to have, there's different decisions we want to make, and we want to be able to make this decision intelligently. And often, like, what decision we want to make here is going to be sort of something ISPA and ISPB will agree to as a business point of view, but of course we need to have the information for our routing to actually implement that, to actually, whatever decision we made, to actually do that decision. You know, if we agreed in our contract that I am going to not say, you know, if my traffic comes from this side of the Pacific, it's not going to, I'm not going to make you send it. How do we actually implement that? And when we implement that, we probably want to do it in a way where, in the unlikely event that, like, this link goes down, we still use the other path. You know, we don't want it to be the case that we're going to have that preference to, even if that makes it less reliable. So we're going to talk about the protocol. You know, that's the primary way that we share sort of routes between ISPs. So how we tell them, here are the things I can connect you to, and this is what we're going to use to feed OSPF and other protocols like that. And the protocol is called the Border Gateway Protocol, or BGP. So this is for sending routes between networks. What you do with those routes is up to you. Typically what you'll do is you'll kind of insert them in something like OSPF or RIP. You'll just add them to routes on your network. You might filter them out if there's things you don't want to use. And BGP, kind of confusingly, is used both between networks and within a network. We're going to mostly ignore the within a network part, because it's not clear to me like it's always used within a network. But basically, the goal of the protocol is to share a list of routes. So it's used whenever routers connect, and this is sometimes called eBGP or exterior BGP. And it's used within an autonomous system. That's what we call sort of our one network for the purpose of BGP. To share routes within that were learned externally within the AS. So to make sure that if ISPA learns a route here, it's going to share it with its routers over here and here so they know, oh, you can go to that router to send it out of this network. And the router, in this system are responsible for constructing a list of routes to offer. So this is probably from OSPF, et cetera. So they'll have some sort of, they'll get their OSPF view of the network and they'll filter that in some way to produce the list of routes to output. And they'll take the list of routes and put it into OSPF so we know how to get routes not just to things within our network, but things outside our network. And I guess a terminology thing, you'll sometimes see, sometimes we'll call sort of the OSPF or other internal routing protocol. IGP in this context. So BGP border, so sometimes we'll see people in the network community call the one you use, not the border, your IGP. So they'll say OSPF is our IGP, meaning it's our interior protocol for routing, which is not the same thing as IBGP, which is confusing. Yeah?
When you say like each router constructs a list of routes,
All routers that are running BGP. Okay. So this only needs to be the border routers, but if we're running the interior BGP, it might be the case that routers that aren't border routers learn the information in the same way. But they probably don't have any routes to offer, not going to be configured to offer any routes because they aren't connecting to other systems. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Other questions? Yeah.
Why is it called border routers and not just the routers that are peering with the other external?
Why is it border routers and not just routers that are peering with other? So border routers will be our name for including all the peering routers. So we'll consider it a border router if it's connecting from RAS to another AS. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so good. To get clarified, yes. Other questions? Okay. So unlike the protocols we've seen before, BGP kind of has a different perspective on reliability. So BGP is a TCP-based protocol. So they're concerned about reliability. And it's a stateful protocol. So the way it works is each router keeps track of what routes are advertised. And you don't just like periodically resend that list. There's a command to add or withdraw things from that list. So it's not like this inspector. We keep resending everything. We just have a notion of here are the routes that are currently advertised. If you want to change that, you send out or withdraw commands. And if you drop your TCP connection, we assume the list is entirely bogus, basically. And in BGP, we're going to send routes. And a common name you'll see for these are prefixes. And they'll commonly be said to be announced from one network to another. They're called prefixes because the network is the important part of the announcement. The announcement also has other information in it, but the network, which is typically, that CIDR notation idea, we can specify network that specificity, is going to be the thing that the main information we're sending. But we're going to have some other information. So we're going to send our IP prefix. And this is going to work for IPv4 and IPv6. But we're going to send some other extra stuff. And we'll learn there's also something called BGP communities, which we'll talk about later, included in here. So we'll have the IP prefix, so, you know, R. You know, this sort of, you know, our range of addresses that this covers. We'll have an AS path, so that's a list of autonomous systems with their numbers that this route goes through. So that AS path is there to detect loops. So this is basically a distance vector protocol. You know, we're sending a distance vector. Our distances are weird. We don't have traditional distances because everyone has a different notion of what the distance should be. But we're sending a list of here are the places you can go. And the distance comes from, well, I like this peer better than this other peer or whatever. You know, that's going to be decided by each autonomous system what the effective distances are. But because it's a distance vector protocol, we have to do extra work to prevent loops. So how we're going to prevent loops is with this AS path idea. We're just going to have a list of where this route comes from. And if we would ever have a duplicate added to that list, we just discard it. We'll also have the next top router. So if we have kind of directly connected routers, usually this is kind of boring, right? That, you know, my router is telling you, here's a route, it goes through me. But where this is not boring is when we're sharing the routes less directly, like in that IBGP idea. We're getting this route. This route was sent to one border router and we're telling it to another one. That's, you know, on the other side of our network. And we have some preference information that's shared with it. So one is this something called a multi-exit discriminator, which is information to say this way entrance is better than the other entrance. So this is precisely for the situation I show you where we have like the Nova connection and the Japan connection. This is how we can communicate that, hey, it's better for me if you send packets to this network through Japan, not through Nova. So the multi-exit discriminator is where that information can go. Note that, you know, it's not mandatory to use that, it's just provided. And there's also what's called a local preference. So when we're sharing routes within our autonomous system, we're going to assign sort of what our preference is for that route. And the protocol has a way to put that there. And this will be something the system administrator configures. So for example, if I have an ISP that I know is really expensive, I might configure a lower local preference to avoid sending traffic to them, except if I really need to. Or probably higher local preference, but a worse local preference. So questions on our components of the routes we send? And so we're going to have our key scenario. So we have our same scenario. We have our ISPs that are connected to each other. And we're basically going to send list of networks to each other. So for example, if we're talking BGP here, web host has a connection to ISP A, and it's going to send, hey, I can go to the network 3FFF132 via an empty AS path, you know, that doesn't include anything yet. You're going to say where it comes from. And the ISP A is going to tell the web host, here are all the networks I can go to. And similarly, we're going to have ISP, web host is going to tell ISPB the same thing. I can get to the network I run, and the web host is going to advertise its networks, ISPB. And in this case, we know from here that this office is connected to ISPB, so it's going to be advertised. And when we advertise it, we're going to say there's an AS path that includes AS64502, the AS of the office. That's where this route comes from. And we have that information, so we know that if we forward this here, the office realizes it. If we had a direct connection from the web host to the office, we would know not to keep forwarding that route. That's why that information is there. And you can see here, like, our web host going to C is going to advertise its network, and C is going to say, oh, I have a path to the office via AS64502 and AS64000. and I have a path to the school network 3FF7AB via 6400. Right. So it's going to tell us all the routes it's willing to serve to us, you know, and also their AS paths. And similarly, when ISP C and D, like the reason why ISP C is telling us about this routes is that ISP D is going to share them with it. And I guess something I note here is that in the case of this school here, our route advertisements only include this ISP because the school doesn't run BGP. So they only have one connection that doesn't make sense for them to run BGP. They just have some IP addresses from ISPD, and ISPD handles all that stuff for them. And that's probably the most common situation. Like when you have a network at home, you don't run BGP on it. You just rely on your ISP handling that for you. So this is like your typical this school situation here where we just, you know, where ISPD just handles announcing their routes. That's typically what happens. So the only case where we have to run our own AS is when we have multiple connections, so it's not good enough to have one ISP handle it for us. Questions about sort of which routes we're announcing in this picture? Okay, so I kind of showed it as we have one connection between each ISP and router, but we know that that's not actually true. So typically, you know, let's say I have ISPB and a company here, we'll have probably multiple connections between routers, and we'll run BGP on each of them. And the announcements we make, you know, might be different for them. So typically, you know, we will exchange routes to the same networks. That's not required. You could have different networks, some networks only be offered through one router. But typically you'll offer everything because you want to handle if one of those routers goes down, but you want everything to still be reachable. But you can include these sort of extra information like this multi-exit discriminator to let the other network know, hey, you know, you should probably send stuff through this path, this router, not this other route. And so we have, yeah, two instances of the protocol running. And also, we're going to run internal BGP between all the routers within our ISP and company A, all the routers in company A. So everyone has all the routes that were learned from external networks and knows what all the options are for the purpose of like doing something like OSPF. Okay, so we have ways of getting routes. So there's a question of like which ones do we choose when we have multiple options? And to a large extent, this is a local policy question. So I'm going to tell you what's typically done. But if you configure the network, if you're configuring the autonomous system, you don't have to obey any of these rules. You can choose whatever order you like. It's your network. But what's conventionally done is that we always use the most specific route. So sometimes someone might advertise a route to a /40 and a /39, let's say, for IPv6. And the rule that almost everyone follows is that you always go to the more specific run over the less specific one, if both apply. With the caveat that most large networks reject very small address ranges. So typically I think, you know, sort of smaller than /24 for v4 or /48 for v6, they'll typically just discard those. And the justification for that is that routers need space for their routing tables and high-performance TCAM stuff, and that's expensive. And they don't want to encourage you to like have a separate route for every, you know, every two IP addresses. So they're just not going to accept the small routes. Also, BGP like can run slowly if you have lots of routes. So yeah, there's reasons why they don't want to accept small routes, so they don't. But other than that, more specific sort of smaller address range takes precedence over larger. Then we apply any local policy after that typically. So I had this local pref idea, so it will have some system administrator configured rules to set a local pref. Typically it will be like connections from this ISP have local pref 1000, connections from this one have local pref 2000, typically rules like that. So those will apply. But then we might still have a tie. So then if we still have a tie, we typically use the shortest AF path, with the idea being that's probably closer to the network. Now, we don't really know that because some of those ASs represent a network that spans the globe, right? But our notion is that it should be better, so that's kind of the heuristic that almost everyone uses. Then typically, a tiebreaker after that, if you still have a tie, is a lower AS number. Then, if you've chosen to honor multi-exit discriminators, you'll take the lower multi-exit discriminator. And this is usually a deliberate choice network operators make, whether or not to do this. And then you'll take the best route you have. So if you have two options, you'll choose the one that's closest on your local network. So questions? And this strategy, you know, this is not only kind of important to know if you're, you know, making this choice, but it's important to know because this is the control I have if I'm telling you routes over what you do, right? It's based on what you're going to do. So we mentioned the multi-exit discriminator idea. So that's how we're going to try to get our preference in this scenario, is that we're going to say that our Tokyo network has a lower multi-exit discriminator the closer you get to Tokyo. And that's going to be how we're going to, how ISPA is going to tell ISPB, please send the traffic from Tokyo, not from Virginia. So because of this strategy, there's some things that you can and do to get your preference for routes. So one thing that is pretty common is you can prepend your AS to your AS path. So you'll commonly see, if you look at real BGP announcements, and we'll look at some examples in a bit, that you can have several copies of your AS number on it. And the purpose of that is just to make the AS path longer to tell other people, please don't use this route unless you have to. You can also, technically, you don't have to announce all the routes from all your routers. Now, there's a reason why this is typically not done, and that's because you typically want to have a backup path. And if you don't announce it, there's no backup unless you start announcing it again. You also can use the less, more specific idea. You can announce a more specific route you can announce a large route in more specific pieces, and those more specific pieces will take precedence over the larger one. And you can often sort of cooperate with other networks to have them forward your routes in different ways than they might otherwise. And there's a mechanism for this that BGP has where you can add metadata to routes called BGP communities. And often ISPs will configure that to let you control things like, you know, if you say, want to send this route to your ISP, but don't want your ISP to forward it to a certain other ISP, that's bad. You can tell them, you can send your route with this tag on it saying, hey, ISP, don't forward it to ISP B. I have some other way of getting there. So, here I have, yeah. I should get my. So, but I guess as a concrete example of kind of the information. So this is information from Hurricane Electric, which is a large-ish ISP. And this is what this is information reconstructed from the BGP announcements that they see. For AS225, which is UVA. And from the BGP announcements they see, we are connected to this AS40220. And that's connected to, I think this is Cogent, and some other networks, and we're also connected to this AS here, AS3356. And this is information constructed because Hurricane Electric is a large ISP, they got lots of BGP announcements, and this is just looking at the AS paths and their BGP announcements. What did they see? What ASs did they go through? And probably I should do here. Do I have this? Yes. And we can see kind of on they have like a list of the actual announcements they saw. So this is their super looking glass. And I searched for this is one of UVA's IP ranges. And you can see here that we have an announcement here. It went through from AS225 to AS40220, which is labeled Virginia Tech. We'll talk more about that in a sec, through this SG.GS that they learned from this server called routeviews.sg. SG probably stands for Singapore. And we can see the other information that was on the route they received. So it had this med value. It lacked RPKI evaluation, which is a way of cryptographically verified routes, which is surprisingly not deployed as very much as you might think it would be. And they have sort of other copies of this route. So most of these go through this AS40220. If we go to the very, it was, get out of the way of doing this quickly. So if we exclude the ones with that go through 40220, we can see that we have routes that are announced through AS3356, which is labeled as level 3 parent. And we can see that their AS path has 8 copies of UVA. And what's happened there is that UVA doesn't want you to use this route. But we have it just in case as a backup. So the way we've announced said we don't want you to use this route is we put 8 copies, not just instead of 1, of RAS on it. And this is a common strategy for sort of how you control how other people use your routes. So as far as like what are these things? So AS40220, it was labeled as Virginia Tech, but it's actually the Maria Research Network, which has this helpful diagram on their website of the connections they have. So they have, the dark lines are 100 gigabits. So they have some 100 gigabits channels of some sort that run from Charlottesville to Northern Virginia. I think Rex DC is really Ashburn, not actually just DC, and to other various institutions in the state, and also we have some connections to Atlanta, so we presumably meaning that we won't lose internet if Ashburn goes down. And this is our primary ISP, and it's labeled Virginia Tech because Virginia Tech is the primary administrator of it, and in the records for the AS, they're the contact information, but that's really who AS40220 is. And There is a website that's common, that's sort of commonly used if you're like an ISP or a major network, if you want to figure out how do I connect to other networks, called PeeringDB. You could also look up networks on their Whois information. When you register an AS, you have to put contact info. And when you register an IP block, you're supposed to have contact info. But this kind of tells, you know, this is information for other networks about, hey, if you want to figure out who is this AS40220 and how do I get a better connection to them? There's information, and you can see that they're saying here, oh, we have two places you can connect to us. One in at the Digital Realty Atlanta data center, and one at the Equinix data centers in Ashburn. And here are the IP addresses, but you probably need to contact them to actually make that work. So we also had this secondary AS, AS3356, which was labeled Level 3. Level 3 used to be one of the largest ISPs. They were acquired by Lumen, which also owns Brightspeed. So that's who they are now. And this is their business product page. And it says, and these things are always priced at call for a quote. So. But that's our backup connection, and that's why we have the example of the 8x prepending there, is because presumably we're paying a lot of money for that and don't really want to compare it to the other connection and really don't want to use it if we don't have to. Okay, so. And I mentioned PeeringDB. So PeeringDB like is just commonly used, bizarrely commonly used, but there's also like Whois records. So Whois is a protocol for getting information, though most commonly there's a website with records these days. Though they're still called Whois records because they used to be gotten through a special protocol called Whois. So with what we've shown so far, like it basically seems like, you know, if we want to connect our networks, we're gonna have to have our router connect to each other router. And it seems like, oh, we're gonna have to run sort of special connections for each one. And this, you know, kind of maybe doesn't scale if we want to connect to like hundreds of other networks. So there's a common thing which has happened, you know, to kind of make this easier, that people run these what are called internet exchanges. So this is a local network, typically in a metro area, sometimes we're just within a data center, metro area, or you know, or just data center for connecting networks. And often run at or by a so-called carrier neutral data center. So what I mean by carrier neutral is that there's some data centers which are run by ISP, large ISPs. And that's usually considered unpleasant if you're like AT&T, you don't want to go to Verizon's data center and lease space from Verizon there. But you might be okay leasing space from someone like Equinix, who is not affiliated directly with any ISP, and offers connections to multiple ISPs. So these internet exchanges are these local networks typically run by a carrier-neutral data center or by a third party, but at carrier-neutral data centers. With the idea being that you connect your router to this local network that's a very high bandwidth local network typically, like 100 gigabit ports, maybe more. And I guess this provides sort of connections, you know, between sort of lots of sort of networks, routers. So like you might have like 100 networks connected to this one sort of local internet exchange, and by just connecting one wire to your router, you know, 100 gigabit fiber, you can have connections to these hundreds of networks, and this works a lot better for small, connecting to small networks, right? If you're connecting to a network that only has a gigabyte per second of traffic, and you're AT&T, you know, it's not, you might not be happy like dedicating a port on your very expensive router to that. But if you can connect to 100 of them with one port, that's pretty nice. And if you're a small ISP, this is really attractive because you can go to one place and get connections to get peering with lots of other networks with one physical connection. And often, you know, these internet exchanges will have route servers. So if we have this local network and I'm connecting to 100 other networks there, and most of those 100 other networks are connecting to 100 other networks there, that's 10,000 BGP connections. That's a lot. So to mitigate that, well, there's commonly they use this idea of route servers, where rather than connecting directly to the other network, you'll connect to this route server that will forward everyone's routes to you and vice versa. Just to mitigate the number of connections, that's another advantage of going through these internet exchanges, especially for these small networks. Questions about the internet exchange idea? So, and these internet exchanges are where a lot of actual internet traffic exchange happens in various types of these. Okay, so I mentioned that we could have metadata on BGP routes that I called communities. And I kind of gave the example that you might use this to control how your routes propagate. So large ISPs typically have like a list of here are communities that you can use that will affect how we use your routes and how we send your routes out to other people we connect to. And I'll give the example of Internet 2. So Maria, that our main ISP, that local Virginia area research network, they are connected to Internet 2, which is a major U.S. University-focused network. They're not an ISP because they don't provide general internet connectivity, but they have peering relationships with a lot of things you consider internet companies like Google and Dropbox and things like that. And they have this list here of communities that they support. So a BGP community is kind of specified as a list of numbers, typically two. There's extended communities, which are three. And they're saying here that, you know, here are communities you can set on your routes. So one thing you can do is you can change your local prep on our network of your route by passing this 11537 community with another number. The number to specify your local prep. You can also say, you know, I'm connected to this research network. This research network right now has some commercial peers. I don't want my routes going there. I'm not allowed to send commercial traffic on this connection. They have a BGP community you can mark your routes with that will make them filter out which of your routes they re-announce. They also have ways where you can specify, for example, oh, I'd like to prepend my route. I would like to have you append your AS some extra times when you forward the route to make it less preferred. That's a very common type of setting that will give you control over. And they let you do that on a per peer basis. So, for example, they connect to a Nordic research network, and you can say, hey, I would like, you can send tag your routes with saying, when you're sending this to the Nordic research network, prepend the AS three times to make it less preferred, or don't send it there. You know, I have some other way of getting there, I don't want you to do that. And similar for they have a connection to Amazon. If you want to change how that's preferred, you have an option to do that. So there's all these sort of ways we can provide flexibility, even though you don't control Internet 2, but Internet 2 can just keep providing you this functionality where you can control how your routes are used without needing to have Internet 2 configure things for your route specifically. And this is something that's commonly provided by large ISPs if you have a BGP connection to them, that they'll have all these sorts of options that you can use to control how other people use your routes. Okay, so one last thing about BGP is the bad side of BGP. So we'll start with some history. So this is an email from 1997. And this is starts with, I would like to sincerely apologize for everyone who experienced problem due to AS7007 announcements. And basically what happened is AS7007 had a full list of routes they received, and due to a configuration error, they announced each of those routes as a /20. They announced the /24 from each of the routes for the full internet through their BGP connection. And so /24 is smaller than, more specific, the routes preferred to go through AS7007. So they basically took down everyone's internet connection for everyone who received their BGP announcement. All the traffic was misrouted. And that this meant that, you know, they basically took down the, and, you know, this is the apology email you can see being sent contemporaneously. Also sent on a Saturday, which I probably had lots of fun. But this is kind of just, this is a misconfiguration, like makes the whole network unreachable because they just misconfigured it to send all these bogus routes. And this is not the only time this has happened. So in 2008, there was a famous incident with Pakistan and YouTube. So Pakistan Telecom got an order from the government to block YouTube. So how did they implement this? Well, they looked up YouTube's IP address and they added a route in their network for that IP address to go to nowhere. So it's a very easy way to implement that. So they're using the routing protocol to just route it to nowhere. But they misconfigured their BGP announcement, so this route was sent out of BGP. And they only blocked YouTube's IP, not all of Google's IP. So this was more specific than Google's announcement of YouTube's IP. So we have this timeline here where, you know, YouTube's announcing this /22, so 2 to the 10, 1,000 addresses. And their misconfiguration causes them to announce this 256 addresses. That's more specific. Everyone starts using it. And after about an hour, the Google engineers realize, why is YouTube unreachable? And they figure out why. So to try to mitigate this, they realize, okay, let's announce the more specific so people who are closer to us will prefer us. They realized that didn't quite work well enough because Pakistan Telecom was well connected, and especially in that part of Asia. So they started announcing the /25s too, because the more specifics are preferred first. But I mentioned that /25s are often filtered out, so this didn't actually work that well. And then Pakistan Telecom's upstream ISP, the ISP they connect through, started filtering out their routes to mitigate this. They added an extra copy of their AS number on it to make them less preferred. That still wasn't enough. So then they just got rid of all the routes that started with Pakistan Telecom's AS. Just said, we're disconnecting you, fix your network. So these are kind of accidents. These were misconfigurations. This has also been used maliciously. So there's some relatively recent examples, 2022, of attacks on cryptocurrencies where they just took over some piece of cryptocurrency infrastructure by arranging to announce a route to that the IP addresses of that infrastructure and took money, actually monetized this. And to make this harder to detect, it looks like they spoofed the final number of the AS path, so it looked like it was going through another network, which it wasn't. And there's also these mitigations that are meant to deal with this. So one thing is that there's these routing registries that are meant to tell you what IP addresses people are supposed to have. In some cases, they added a bogus entry to the routing registry to make it harder to figure out on the fly that something was wrong. And there's been other concerns about this. So here's an Ars Technica article saying concerns about China Telecom doing whether these so-called BGP hijacks, that being a justification for trying to take them out of the US market. So that's kind of BGP hijacking. So what do we do about that? And historically, there's no verification that when you announce something via BGP, that it's actually yours. We've gotten better. But as you can see from the recentness of these incidents, not that much better. So one solution is that there are these internet routing registries, which are databases telling us what AS corresponds to what IP address. And these are typically used automatically to filter out routes. So if you're running a big ISP, you're going to require your customers to have their routes registered in the internet routing registry. And if it's not there, you're going to reject the advertise. You're going to not filter out the route before you let it go anywhere. This is mostly designed to handle mistakes. It's not really designed to handle malicious attacks. A lot of ISPs will verify which IPs you're supposed to have. And they'll ask for documentation, often like a letter of authority or a letter of agency, basically something on company letterhead from the person who has the IP registered. Before they delegate things. This doesn't work so well if, like, I'm connected to a big ISP, though, right? I'm not going to ask the big ISP, what are all the IPs of your customers? That's just not going to be viable for a big IP, which has, thousands of customers and they're changing every day. But for small customers, you're going to be asked these questions. And the kind of real solution is there's this thing scheme called routing PKI, which is basically a public key scheme to verify routes, where we'll have some public keys issued by INA, the same people who like assign IP addresses to organizations, and that will tell us if the routes come from the right place. Now, it doesn't tell us that they go through the places correctly, right? Because if I have a connection through an autonomous system, that autonomous system could still forward things incorrectly. But it does tell me it went from AS1 to AS2 to AS3 to AS4 to get to me. And this was proposed, this is like kind of a relatively recent thing. It's kind of the main RFC for doing that. And I tried to find statistics on deployment. It's hard to get, but it's not that deployed at this point in time, but that's kind of the goal, and the justification is that, it's actually a problem. So that's everything I have on BGP stuff. So questions? Right. Okay. So our next topic, so originally I was going to cover sockets here. Looking at the assignments, I'm going to cover DNS first and then sockets. So we're going to talk about, I'll use my first 5 minutes of DNS talking here. So we have names and addresses. I think you've mostly seen this before, since I'm going to reuse some CSO2 slides for this. But then we're going to go into more detail. So we have DNS names, which have this kind of hierarchical format. And we have IP addresses, and we need to somehow make them correspond. The main way we do this on the internet is with the domain name system, which is a distributed database. And what I mean by that is, like, kind of the typical way you use this is that you, when you connect to a network, you have one DNS server use. But that's not the only DNS server that's involved in doing this lookup. And you'll ask that, your machine will ask that DNS server, say, what's the address for cs.virginia.edu? And what we can do is, you know, if we want to get the full answer to that, we're first going to go to a root DNS server, and that's going to tell us, okay, I don't know the answer to that, because it's a distributed database, not the whole database is not on any one machine. It'll just say, here's where you get the information for EDU. We'll go to the EDU server. It'll say, okay, I don't know the answer to that, but I know where the virginia.edu information is. Go to this virginia.edu server. And virginia.edu says, well, I don't manage cs.virginia.edu. Go to this cs.virginia.edu server. So there's another thing we're going to do here, which is that, well, if we did this every time, this would be pretty slow. So we're going to have our, we're going to cache our responses here. So once our ISP's DNS server returns that cs.virginia.edu is this IP address, which is probably not the IP address anymore, it's going to cache that result and remember it for later. And the scheme we'll use for caching it, because we have to know what happens when the IP address changes, is that the responses will be tagged with a time to live, which is going to be sort of how long you can cache it for. So you can see here we have a hierarchy in DNS, right? We take our root name and we sort of add things onto it. And there's this, so there's a single root, but then we add things onto it. And we're going to divide this hierarchy up into zones, where each zone is going to be managed by the same set of servers. Typically, we'll have multiple servers for a zone, and we'll call the servers that are responsible for storing the, you know, the original information for that zone authoritative servers for that zone. And you can see here that a zone doesn't need to be a single level. So for example, canvas.ats.virginia.edu is in the same zone as engineering.virginia.edu. And that's a fine thing to do because it doesn't, the administrator decided it doesn't make sense to have a separate set of DNS servers for the ITS subdomain here. But CS happens to have its own, and that's a thing we can do. So we'll talk more about sort of how this works later, and like what is the format of messages for DNS and all that next time.